This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Carrie Egan's book, On Living, shares stories that she has heard as a hospice chaplain from people at the end of life. Egan says her book isn't about dying, but about living. Carrie Egan will appear at events for the McShane Preacher Colloquium Sunday, March 10th, and Monday, March 11th at First Presbyterian Church in Kalamazoo. Carrie Egan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Please describe the job of a hospice chaplain.
So this is a harder question than you might realize. It's a job, I think, that a lot of people, even people who work in hospice sometimes, don't really understand. And I think in large part that's because a good hospice chaplain can be something of a shapeshifter, right? Because when you're a hospice chaplain, you're goal for every patient you go in to see is to help them meet whatever spiritual needs they have. And that can span the universe, right? Every individual person is going to have different spiritual needs at the end of life. And there might be some commonalities and there might be some things that we do over and over again, but every person is unique. And so their needs are going to be unique. So your goal as a hospice chaplain is the same, which is to meet the patient's needs. But patients' needs are always different. So as a hospice chaplain, we work as part of the hospice team. And hospice is very team-based care. And as a hospice chaplain, we don't just take care of the patient, right? We take care of the whole family who's going through this dying process. So as the chaplain, I work with the nurse and the social worker and the volunteers and the aides to go in and to assess what this patient and family need at this time. It can be a very peaceful time, but, you know, for a lot of patients and a lot of families, a lot of things come up as they realize they're dying and that they're facing the end of their life. And so we go in to see what that family needs and we try to meet it. So my particular job on that team is to look at what people's spiritual needs are. And those very often have to do with making meaning out of the life you've lived, right? So a person is facing the end of their life. They don't have any more time or they on hospice, usually they have 6 months or less. And they very often are doing that very hard work of reminiscing and looking back over their life, looking back over the really good times, but also the really difficult times. And they're trying to figure out how it all makes sense, how it makes sense with their religious beliefs that they were brought up with for some people. And for some people, you know, their religion is not very important to them at this point. For some people, it maybe wasn't important during their life, and now the religious beliefs of their childhood become incredibly important. They want to reconnect to that. Some people find religion a really helpful tool to make meaning with, to come to understand themselves and their place in the universe and their relationship with God. Some people find religion to be really hurtful, and they need to work through some of the pain that they've experienced because of religion. Some people have really strong families that help them with this process of meaning making and that question of what does it all mean and am I loved and is there something that happens after death or is this it? And some people don't have a strong family support. So the job of a hospice chaplain, again, we have one goal, which is to meet the patient's spiritual needs, but that can mean a million different things.
And would the role of a chaplain be quite different from, let's say, a priest or a rabbi or some other sort of religious minister?
Yes and no. Some chaplains are priests and rabbis. Some are not ordained. I'm not ordained. I think the easiest way to explain it is that a priest or a rabbi, their role is to preach or teach, right? They preach and teach one specific message. They preach and teach a normative body of ideas, right? That this is real, this is true. Here's what we believe, right? Here's what we believe and here's why we believe it. And they preach and they teach that. A chaplain does not preach or teach. It's too late in some ways for that, right? We're not there to teach anyone because they don't have that much time left. A chaplain comes in and does not say, here's what you should believe. A chaplain comes in and says, what do you already believe? What do you already believe? What were the ideas that you grew up with? What were the beliefs that you developed? What's your relationship with God now or not? If you don't have a relationship with God, we work with people who don't even believe in God. Where are you right now? And the chaplain meets you where you are right now and says, how do these beliefs match up with your life experience? Because sometimes they don't, right? You might be walking around, a very common belief people walk around with is they might not even know they have this belief until they're sort of face to face with the fact it didn't come true. They might believe, if I'm a good person, nothing bad will happen. And then there they are at 50 years old with a terminal cancer diagnosis. And they'll say, how can this happen? Right? I'm a good person. I'm a good person. I did everything right. And how can this be happening to me? So that's a place where, you know, you have this belief that if I'm a good person, God will protect me. And then all of a sudden it doesn't feel true. And that can cause an enormous amount of pain, right? You can feel abandoned by God. You can feel like you were a fool. How could I have believed that? The whole range of emotions. So a chaplain is going to walk into that situation and say, okay, where are you right now in your spiritual life? Whether that's a very robust spiritual life or almost no spiritual life whatsoever, where are you right now? And what do you need to come to some sort of peace and meaning so that you can have a good death?
So do people generally accept the fact that a chaplain is there, even if, let's say, they are an atheist or perhaps an agnostic or someone who didn't have a lot of religious background going on in their life? Are they still receptive to the idea of a chaplain being there? Or are there people who say, you know what, I never believed in God. I would prefer you leave the room.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are people who definitely say, I don't have any need for you. And you say, okay, here's my card. If you change your mind, give me a call. The chaplain is not required to visit. So at least at the hospice agency that I have worked at, and I don't know if this is sort of like an official JACO rule or if I can't speak to that. But from my understanding, what I understood of my role is that the chaplain has to reach out within 5 days of admission and just say, here I am, you know, with a phone call. If the person's in a nursing home, you might stop by their room and say, I'm the chaplain. I work with the hospice team. And if you want me, I am available for you. And if the patient doesn't want you, don't go, right? That's your spiritual need. For some people, their spiritual need is to not talk to the chaplain, and that's fine too. So we don't go see, for the most part, we do not go see every patient or family. We go and visit with the patients or families who request the chaplain, and not everybody does. Some people say, listen, I have a priest, I have a rabbi, I have a pastor, I'm all set. Some people say, I hate religion, I want nothing to do with it, I don't like you, chaplain. Some people might say, listen, I'm open to it. It's fine, but I'm really busy. I want to spend the majority of my time with my grandchildren, not talking to the chaplain. So some people don't want the chaplain. Some people do.
So there are some very personal stories in your book that people shared with you during that time in hospice as they were nearing the end of their life. In order to put the book together, did you get permission from people before they died? Did you get permission from family members? How did it all come together?
So every story that's in the book, those were people who said, I would like my story shared with a larger audience. That was their spiritual need, which you'll notice it's a very small book. There were not that many people who said that. But there were some. The first story, I call her Gloria. No one has their real name in the book. And there's no defining details or characteristics of anybody in the book. But Gloria very specifically said, it starts with a story, and that's why I started there. It starts with the story of Gloria, who had a very eventful life. And she said one day, we were sitting on the couch, and she said, you know, I always wanted to meet a writer. And I had written a book, you know, 12 years previously, but I had not told her I'd written a book. I never thought I'd write a second book. I thought that sort of part of my life was done. I was there as her hospice chaplain, but she says out of the blue, you know, I always wished I could meet a writer. And, you know, I've been through so much. I wish I could tell other people my story so they could learn from me. She's like, because I certainly haven't learned. She'd always say, I never got wise. You know, you're supposed to be wise at the end of life. And I never got wise. I've been through all this stuff and no one's learned. I really wish I could meet a writer. She specifically wanted to meet Pat Conroy. She said, you know, beach music. She said, Prince of Tide. She said, if I could meet a writer, I'd just give him my stories. I'd give him my stories, and I'd say, here, write a book, and maybe someone else could learn from all my stories because I haven't learned anything. And I didn't actually say anything at first. I just listened, and because I wasn't there as a writer, and I wasn't entirely sure where she was going with this. So I have learned in my experience, if you aren't really sure where someone's going, your best bet is just to sit there quietly and listen attentively and see where it goes. So I didn't really say anything. I just went, huh, yeah. And she said, you know, I used to pray about it. I used to pray and pray and pray that I would meet a writer. And I never did. I never met a writer, but I want to meet a writer. I want someone to write down my stories and tell people. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, huh, oh man, all right, should I say something? Is it even appropriate to say something? And as I'm sitting there thinking, she goes on and she gets very teary and she goes, but you know, I guess some prayers don't get answered. I've been praying my whole life and I guess this is, it's the end and I guess this prayer doesn't get answered. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to say something. And I said, you know, Gloria, did I ever mention that I had once written a book? And she looked at me and she said, you? She didn't believe me at all. And I said, yeah, yeah, me. And she goes, a real book? And I said, yes, a real book. And she still didn't believe me. And she goes, published? And I said, yes, published and everything. And then she threw her hands up to the ceiling and she said, Jesus, I thought you were going to send me a man. And she turned back to me and she goes, Gary, it's you. You're the writer. She said, the Holy Spirit answered my prayers. And I have already told you all my stories. Now it's easy. You just got to write them down. It was not easy. But she very explicitly, not only did she give permission for me to tell those stories, she brought it up. She wanted those stories told. There was another patient I had who actually was on television. He said he had a message that he wanted to get out to thousands of people, that he thought the Holy Spirit had a job for him to do, that he had to get this message out, and he couldn't even get out of his chair. How could he get a message to thousands of people when he couldn't get out of his chair? And it just so happened that that morning, a television producer had called me. They had read an essay of mine that was on CNN. It was a television producer from PBS, and they called and said, we'd like to come and follow you around and videotape you with your patients. And I had said, absolutely not. You're crazy. No, that's never going to happen. And they said, why not? And I said, because I don't have any patients that want to be on television. And they said, well, how do you know? You haven't asked your patients. And I said, listen, I'm not going to ask my patients. I said, unless somebody says to me, I have a spiritual need to be on TV, I'm never going to ask my patients if they want to be on television. And then that day, literally later on that day, he says, I have a message to get out to thousands of people. And I said, do you want to be on TV? And he said, yes. And so some of his stories are in the book as well. So the stories in the book are, you're right, there are thousands of stories that I know, but that I don't tell because they were just told to me. But there were a handful of people who not only did they give permission for the stories to be told, they brought it up. They specifically wanted their life stories to have a larger audience, which at first seemed very strange to me, right? That seemed very alien and foreign to me as a hospice chaplain, and I didn't write, and this is over years and years, I didn't write a book immediately after these things happened. Because it took me a while, frankly, to come to understand that for some people, part of their spiritual journey was sharing their life stories with a larger audience. It's unexpected, I think it's pretty rare, but it happened. It happened to me, and so I wrote a book about it.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Kerry Egan is the author of On Living. It chronicles some of the stories told to her as a hospice chaplain. Egan will speak at events for the McShane Preacher Colloquium on Sunday, March 10th and Monday, March 11th at First Presbyterian Church in Kalamazoo. Do the things that people say at the end of their life, whether it is just sort of an assessment of what they experienced, or as sometimes happens and you write about in the book, people sharing a secret which they had held for a long time, Does that affect the way that they are remembered and mourned after they do pass away?
Listen, at the end of life, right, people do lots of different things. Some people will share those secrets with their families, and maybe there will be some reconciliation. Maybe there won't. And there are lots of people who die with their secrets. So there's no way to give a blanket answer to that. You know, like, does it affect how they're mourned or how they're remembered? It depends on the individual dynamics of that family. Those family secrets are really tough. And part of the reason people have kept them for so long is they don't know how people are going to respond to them. And sometimes family members respond really well. Oftentimes family members already knew. That always shocked me, with how many times people thought they were keeping a secret. And when it finally came out, turns out everybody already sort of knew. It was not such a secret after all. That probably is more common than anything else, frankly. It's a risk, right? It's a risk. I mean, I think what most people want at the end of life, I tried not to make broad generalizations, but if I was going to make the broadest I could, I would say most people, not everyone, but most people, and you'll see this in the book, I think what most people at the end of life want is connection, right? They want, that's the spiritual journey. They want connection to the people they love. They want connection to a larger sense of meaning in their own lives. Some people want a connection to God. Some people don't use that word God, but I would call it God, but they wouldn't, so I don't. They want a sense of connection to something larger than themselves. They want to connect. And oftentimes they hold the secret because they're afraid of damaging that connection. And that's why they keep the secret. But it turns out keeping the secret is what damages the connection. That's what people, I think, want at the end of life. And maybe that's what we all want in the middle of life, too. You know, I think we want to be connected. I think we want to feel loved and to be loved and to know we are loved. I think that's what most people want.
As you say, we all have different ways of dying, just like we all have different ways of living. And, you know, it occurs to me that not everybody ends up in hospice. Some people die very suddenly, and people may hear hospice, and that sounds very scary to them in a lot of ways. But ultimately, we're all going to die. Based on your experience, do you think that the people who do get some time to realize that the end is near and therefore the time to reflect and maybe to say something, that maybe they're the lucky ones?
Yeah, I do think that. I think that they're the lucky ones, and I think their families are lucky. I don't think they feel lucky in the moment, right? If you're watching, and I almost bite my tongue saying that, because I don't want someone whose spouse is, you know, dying of bone cancer to hear me on the radio and you know, throw the radio across the room, or their phone, which I wouldn't blame them. I wouldn't blame them. If your loved one is dying of cancer and you heard me just say, oh, you're lucky, feel free to, like, throw me across the room, because in the moment, I'm sure you don't feel lucky. You don't feel lucky. Of course not. The person you love is dying horribly, painfully in front of you, and you're, you know, giving them as much morphine as you can to get them through the day. And they don't feel lucky. They don't. So in that respect, no. No one's lucky to suffer like that. No one is. But if there is something good to be said about it, it's that they do have time to be aware and to consciously make those connections. Someone dies of a massive stroke, you know, or a massive heart attack. They haven't had that. They've had the time to make the connections, but they haven't had the awareness necessarily. They might not have had the awareness that they need to make those connections. They might have lived their lives thinking, I have plenty of years to reconcile with, you know, my mother. I have plenty of years to apologize to my husband. I'll deal with that later. I'll do what I want later. Thinking they have all the time in the world. I think if you have a terminal diagnosis, as devastating as that is, you do know that your time is limited and you have a little bit more motivation and a little bit more awareness and spaciousness with which to do that meaning-making work. The suffering certainly isn't lucky. Not at all. you know, it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes I think, oh, I want to die in my sleep. I want to have a heart attack in my sleep. Because when you see people suffer physically, sometimes for a long time, you don't forget it. You don't forget that.
There's a chapter title in your book, If I Had Only Known, I Would Have Danced More.
Yeah, someone said that to me.
And that leads us to that whole question of regret and the things that you would have done differently if you had it to do over again. You know, is it possible to read your book and maybe think about what people say when the end is there and maybe live a little bit better before that time when we're talking to a hospice chaplain?
I hope so. I mean, that's the point of the book, right? I mean, that's why people wanted these stories told, as they said, I wish I had figured this out sooner. I didn't. Maybe someone else could. Maybe someone else can read my story and figure out sooner, faster than I figured it out. People ask all the time, like, what do people who are dying regret? They always want to know. They want to know two questions. What are their last words and what are their big regrets? And it took me a while to figure out that I actually don't think most people have this deep interest in death and dying. I don't think that's why they're asking those questions. I think what they're really asking is, what am I going to regret? And what are the most important things to say? What are the most important things that I should say, right? So you're asking, what are people's last words? Because you really want to know, what are the important things to say? And you're asking, what do people regret? Because you really want to know, what am I going to regret? So instead of focusing on those questions, what do other people say? What do other people regret? What I tell people is to think about what you regret now. Right? Nobody at the end of life ever said to me, I can't believe I regret this. I can't believe I regret not spending any time with my children. No one is shocked by their regrets, right? No one is like, I woke up this morning and I can't believe it. Nobody says that. Everybody already knew what their regrets were. And this whole focus on last words is sort of very Hollywood. Most people's last words, most people are in and out of consciousness. Many people are delirious. Many people don't have last words, that they're even conscious or aware of their last words. When people ask, you know, what are their famous last words? What they really want to know is, what should I tell my family now? And so those are the questions you should ask yourself. What do I want my friends and family to know now? If I want them to know I love them, you should say I love you right now. If you regret not talking to your mother more on the phone, you should pick up the phone and call her right now. You're not going to be shocked at the end. You know what your regrets are. You know what you want to say. If you take the time to really think about it, and you should do that now. Because you know what? You're right. You might not be in hospice. You might have a heart attack. You might have a stroke. You might have a car accident. You might turn on your stove and you have a gas leak. I mean, who knows, right? We don't really know. So instead of focusing on other people and their regrets and their last words, you should think about what your hopes are right now and work while you have the health and the time and the energy to make those things come true.
Earlier in your book, you write, I don't know that listening to other people's life stories as they die can make you wise, but I do know that it can heal your soul. I know this because those stories healed mine. Explain a little bit more about what you mean there.
So my hope in writing this book is that the big circular structure of hope, I guess, people tell their stories, and if you read the book, you will see how people go about the process of making meaning, right? In chaplaincy, we talk about meaning making. How do people do this? How do people do meaning making? And as a chaplain, you know, we have this education and this experience and training to facilitate people as they make their own meaning. But a really important part of being a chaplain is also making your own meaning, right? It's being aware of your own history and concerns and what you bring to the table, right? You have to be very aware when you're a chaplain of what you're bringing to the table so you don't sort of ooze yourself all over your patients, right? So while the patient is doing meaning-making, the chaplain should be doing it as well. The chaplain should be very aware of what's going on in her own heart and mind while she's doing this work. And that's part of your training as a chaplain. So the idea in the book is that you're going to see people do this meaning-making work at the people who are dying. But you're also going to see me doing some meaning-making work. I had a very traumatic experience that I relate a little bit in the book and had a very hard time making meaning of it. And so I talk a lot about it, and this is true, that it really was, for me, watching patients do this meaning-making work over and over and over again that gave me the strength and the courage and the tools in some ways to do it for myself. You know, what did this traumatic experience mean to me? And my hope then is that the reader on the third level will see me doing it and watch my patients doing it, and they will say, I can do this too. I can take a step back and look at my hard stories. You know, I call them hard stories, right? That's what they are. They're hard stories that we all live through. I can look at my hard stories, and I can make some meaning of them. I can hold them up to the light and not be afraid of them, and figure out what they mean in the course of my existence and my relationship with God and my relationship with my friends and my family. So that's my hope. When I say heal your soul, that's what I mean, that you can take those hard stories, those places in your heart that still hurt, that are still a wound, that still don't make sense, right? That just don't make sense, that you'll find a way to grapple with them by watching, by reading other people do it.
Kerry Egan is a hospice chaplain and the author of the book On Living. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview. I really appreciate it.
Kerry Egan will speak at events for the McShane Preacher Colloquium on Sunday, March 10th and Monday, March 11th at First Presbyterian Church in Kalamazoo. Links with more details can be found at WMUK.org. You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast through Apple iTunes and by searching for podcasts in Google Music. You can also find the interviews on our website, WMUK.org, and through the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.